in their green zones.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society Concert Series, which continues Saturday, November 18th with Hubby Jenkins. A live concert of old-time American music following African-American influence in America's traditional music forms. That's Hubby Jenkins on Saturday, November 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Come on over to Rhythm Shack with Mike Fisher for high-energy roots rock, Americana, jam bands, blues, and more. Every second and fifth Monday from 3 to 5:30 a.m. That's Rhythm Shack here on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland, and KBOO.fm.
KBOO. Welcome to Negotiating Dramatic Events with Grace Growing Medicine Reed, the show that explores our experiences, our strengths, hopes, and fears as we strive to meet the needs of others as well as our own. And now, Grace Growing Medicine Reed.
Hello. Today I'm interviewing Emily DeHoff. She is a young person, and she's a friend. And we're going to be talking about the promise of world peace today. That's a very important subject, I think, considering what's going on. What are your feelings about, do you think world peace is possible considering what's going on, Emily? And I know you're a very, you're a teacher. You teach math. She tried to teach me math, but oh well.
Hi. Yeah. Hi. Yeah, I think there's a difference between possible and easy. It's definitely not easy, but I do think eventually it is possible.
Well, and it's important to. It's important. So how do we get world peace? I mean, how do we even get personal peace, let alone world peace? So peace starts with the promise of world peace, by the way, is it's a Baha'i statement on peace by the Universal House of Justice, which actually is based in Haifa, Israel. So this is very fortuitous to be talking from Haifa, Israel. I'm talking from Portland, but considering what is happening in Haifa, Israel, with this group of peace-loving people who produced this document back in the 60s, I think, or 80s, I guess, 60s or 80s, and then they're still very much involved with promising this, and it's not just a promise. It's not just a, well, maybe we'll have world peace. It's actually a promise. We will have world peace. My show is based on being seen, heard, and understood. So the voices of noble-minded souls, peace-loving people, are calling for the end of conflict and struggle on all sides right now, and peace-loving people everywhere, coming from all kinds of of places all over the world are now standing up and saying, oh my gosh, no more, no more, no more, no more. Is that something that's, so what do you think of all this, Emily?
I think right now there's a massive amount of awareness that's happening, of like people realizing that maybe the peacefulness that they thought was happening isn't actually the reality. And so all of these very diverse people are recognizing that and standing up and voicing like what they think and what they feel. And I think now the job is to kind of like what the point of your show is, like now is for everyone to listen to what people are saying and really hear them and really see them. And if we can do that and then start building from there, I feel like that's where the potential is.
Yeah, I thought you'd say something like that. Oh, Emily, I miss you.
Miss you too.
This is a Persian prophet, Abdu'l-Bahá, that said, "You observe how the world is divided against itself, how many a land is red with blood and its very dust is caked with human gore." Oh, yeah, huh? And that's actually what's happening right now. And it's been happening ever since humans crawled out of the mud. We've had nothing but war and conflict and war and conflict and war and conflict. And here we go again with the potential for World War III. There's so much, that's very scary for a lot of people right now. From my end, I'm hearing people from all walks of life going, oh, they're frightened. Because, you know, this is a setup for World War III, possibly. Anyway, the breeding ground for all these tragedies is prejudice. Prejudice of race and nation, of religion, of political opinion. And the root cause of prejudice is blind imitation of the past, imitation in religion, in racial attitudes, in national bias, in politics. So long as this gapping of the past persists, just so long will the foundations of the social order be blown to the four winds, just so long will humanity be continually exposed to the direct peril of yet more conflict, more wars. Thoughts, feelings, comments?
Yeah, I think that idea that prejudice is at the root of it is really, like, it kind of takes it out of this idea that it's, oh, it's them doing all the fighting. Like, it's, oh, it's the leaders of the countries, or it's like, it's always someone else. Like, the everyone has prejudice. And so that takes it down to the level of, that's something that I can work on in myself and with the people around me. And if more and more people are doing that, that has kind of a ripple effect that will work its way out and up and down and around.
Yeah. So how do you work for world peace? I mean, for it's another thing that I think about when you said that is, we start with ourselves, and our families, and then we are in a city and a state. That's all over the world, whatever city, state you're in. And then we have nations. We're in the United States, but there are nations. So there's a statement, world unity is possible and essential right now. World unity on how we get to world peace is essential right now. What do you see happening from your, you know, from you being a youth? You're a math teacher. So I call you a youth because I'm 80, as everybody knows on the show, and I know you're young. And Emily was part of my, I had a real MS breakdown, and Emily surrounded me and brought me a lot of peace and love when I was sick not too long ago. So I cherish you, Emily, I really do. And I know you're a very peaceful person, you're intelligent and so on. So you're a math teacher. Tell me about who you're working with, young children, aren't you?
Yes. I work from like everything from 5-year-olds up through middle schoolers. I think when you start thinking about building peace from that context of like just your life and whatever the job is that you have, it can feel kind of inconsequential sometimes. But I think I have to keep reminding myself that it's like, it's the behavior I model that will influence the students that I teach and the people around me. And it's the way that I interact with them and the way that I listen to them and make sure that they feel heard and help model for them how to listen to people and how to learn from each other rather than just kind of arguing at each other all the time.
Is that what they do?
Yes.
Around little kids for a long time. So again, it starts with you and what you're doing in your arena. These are little children. And so many little children are being murdered as we speak on both sides. Little kids. And if we've gotten to a world where it's okay to, and also in this country, if it's okay to shoot down little children at a school or bomb them across the border or whatever. To me, it's like there's only one thing we can do, and that's stop all this and get to world peace. But how is that possible? That it's a big, big, overwhelming subject. It's a big, overwhelming thought. We have to convince ourselves that peace is possible. It's hard work if you don't believe it. And so I think there's a lot of people that don't believe it, which is why we're kind of stuck. If you don't believe it, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's true for so many things. Like when I was in cross country, if I didn't think that I could finish the race, I wasn't going to finish it. I was going to start walking partway through. And I think that's true of anything, that if we aren't able to see it in our heads as like something achievable, then we're gonna put roadblocks in our way to prevent us. Like our disbelief in the end product is gonna stop us from getting there. I get it. It's really hard to imagine that it's possible right now, given everything that's happening. But I think it takes, it kind of takes the ability to notice it on a small scale around you and be able to extrapolate that in your head that, oh, if I see this positive interaction in my life, the ripple effects of that could lead to something much bigger.
And I think it does. It does mm-hmm. lead to. That's a scientific reality that anything I do that's kind today, excuse me, radio people, has a ripple effect. If I'm kind to my neighbor down the hallway, which I had an opportunity to be, I have a neighbor down the hall, and she says, she's a single person. She's cooking Thanksgiving dinner for herself. And so she's got a turkey and the whole thing. And I came around the corner and we stopped and talked in the hallway. And she said, can I bring you a plate? I want to bring you a plate. Are you by yourself? I have a friend. And she said, well, I'll bring you two plates. That's so kind.
Yeah.
And that ripple effect, that ripple effect of just her kindness. And I come home and I don't just forget I had that conversation in the hallway. I had that conversation and I've got something to look forward to. This woman's going to bring me some turkey because I'm not going to buy a turkey for my friend and I. So we're going to have turkey for Thanksgiving. How about that? And so there it goes, you know. And so a little bit more, Emily, on what you think and what you know about this. What are some of the ripple effects, perhaps, that you, well, especially with, what do we, aren't we saying we have to have faith in the human spirit?
That yes, we're given and like the capacity? Potential.
Yeah, the potential. Well, yeah, the potential.
We humans have the capacity to live together in peace. We have to believe that, and we have to know that. And so how do we live together in peace? I know you and I live together in peace. I live a peaceful life with everybody I'm involved with, but how do we live together in peace? When it comes to the worldview, we're looking at this worldview now because of the document, The Promise of World Peace. But we can't be hopeless. We can't be hopeless. And there are so many people that are hopeless right now, which is really the bottom line of this show. I don't want people to feel hopeless, which is why I'm interviewing on this document, because we can't be hopeless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the important things that document talks about is that it's not just, like, when we think of peace, it's not just the lack of firing weapons or like the lack of war. It talks about it being much more than that, like people around the world being able to like collaborate with each other. Like, it talks about the ability for people in different countries to communicate readily with each other, and it talks about like the advancement of women and their rights, and it talks about like education, and like there's all of these aspects to peace that I think are kind of more fulfilling and also richer than just not being at war with each other.
Well, it's easier said than done, though, isn't it?
Definitely.
We can sit here and just say all kinds of beautiful words and stuff. How do we do this?
Well, I think when I think of peace in those ways, in addition to just not being at war, like for me, not being at war is very overwhelming because I don't feel like I have any power over that.
Uh-huh.
But if I think of peace as also all these other things, then like the advancement of women, that's something that I can work on in my own life with the people around me, or the education of children, like equitable education. That's something that I can work on in my own life with the people around me.
Uh-huh.
And like that document talks about, if we can work on all these other things, then the peace will kind of come along with it. And so since those other things feel a little more attainable to me, maybe not attainable, but they feel like something I have a little more influence over, at least in my small circle, that's easier for me to think about than not having wars anymore, which is very overwhelming to me.
Yeah, it's hard to have faith in the human spirit when there's so many, especially if you watch the news, and of course we all do because that's on the news. It's, you know, it's everywhere. It's the topic of the day all over the world, and it's horrendous, and it always has been. I was thinking about my parents. They came from World War One, or my grandparents, World War One, and then my parents, World War Two. I was born in World War Two. And then the Great Depression, and then the Vietnam War, and all these wars, and all these, you know, and I was out protesting that one when I was younger, and so on, so on, so on. And so it just keeps going and going and going. You look back at history, and it's like, again, ever since we caught out of the mud, we've been in conflict with one another. And all of that, and that's a power play. So studying the causes of violence, it seems like war is one of the ways humans oppress each other. So there's that oppression thing, the personal oppression. And so when somebody is, I have master's degree in conflict resolution, restorative justice. So oppression is one of the things I study and try to help. How do you talk when you're talking to people in your little circles? Our little circles, the ripple effect joins other little circles, and then other little circles join other little circles. And I have to think that way because I'm just this old lady sitting in an apartment in downtown Portland, doing this KBOO broadcast and doing all the other stuff that I do. And I do quite a bit of stuff for peace and love and kindness and so on, as you know, and my artwork and everything. But you know, I wake up every day, I'm just this one little old lady. How in the heck am I going to bring world peace? How am I going to be influential?
But that's why I wanted to talk about this, because I want people to understand their your little circle. I mean, it doesn't matter what you do, as long as you're kind and you do everything you can to not oppress yourself and others, and enlarge that little circle, your little arena, and then touch bases with other circles, with the understanding that world peace is not only possible, it's inevitable. We will have world peace eventually. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's very important to remember that even though it's us taking individual actions, we're not doing them individually. I think it's very easy, especially in this society, think about things in terms of like, it's me against the world.
Yeah.
I think it's important to remember that there's a lot of other people in a very similar state of mind who are also trying to influence their little circles. And like, my mom will use this metaphor a lot of the imaginal cells in a chrysalis. When like a butterfly or a caterpillar goes into the chrysalis, there's these imaginal cells that are like, their job is to turn the caterpillar into the butterfly, right? And in the beginning, there's only a couple of them. And when there's very few of them, the caterpillar just like eats the imaginal cells, like the immune system just attacks them. But if there's enough of those cells, then they start transforming the caterpillar into the butterfly. And so until there's enough people taking the individual actions, then it feels kind of like it's me against the world. But once there's enough people and you start seeing them and connecting with them, then that's when like I think the change starts to kind of trickle outwards.
Yeah. By the way, these are things that ways we can work for peace. On the back of this book, there's nine ways we can. It's a pamphlet actually, but nine ways we can work for peace. And I'm actually reading off of that and talking about that right now with just you and I. So if we strive for love and unity within our families, and families are the building block of civilization, the next step is to try to think of people from other countries as members of our extended family. That's really expanding. But if you're working within your family, and then you, so that now we're talking about people from other countries, you know, that's expanding. And that's, how do we do that? How do you do that?
I mean, the first step is bringing more people into your circle. Like if you're just like you and the people that are very similar to you in like your location, then it's difficult to have that sense of like the expansiveness. But it, when you start like seeking out people who have different experiences from you or are in different situations or are in different places, that's when I feel like that expanding part, like the extended family part, kind of starts coming into reality.
Yeah, and I know I don't. I think you live. Do you not live in other countries, or you're thinking about maybe traveling to another country eventually?
Eventually, yes.
And I think, aren't you? May I talk about your dating? You're a young person and you're dating. Who are you dating?
My boyfriend Joe is.
And what is his nationality?
He's from China.
There you go. And if you're involved with somebody from China, aren't you learning a heck of a lot more about China?
Definitely, yeah.
Well, talk about an extension internationally of a circle. So your two circles come together, and you're United States and he's China.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are the practical ways, you know, that's what I'm saying. These are the practical ways in which, not you got up one day and say, Grace and I are going to talk about the promise of world peace, therefore I have to find a guy from China, right?
Yeah, it needs to be just kind of an organic part of your life.
So we can have this conversation. Anyway. I know I lived and worked in Europe many, many years, and got to know people from many different countries as I traveled and shared the Hopi prophecy and did some Native things and worked for addiction issues with compromised people in different parts of Europe, particularly the Sami in the north, from North Norway, North Sweden, North Finland. And I got to know these people. I got to understand them. They're reindeer herders. So I got to help herd reindeers when I was young, doing stuff in Europe. And talk about a different culture, you know? I think about them on a regular basis. I get on Facebook every now and again, or I'll do a Zoom thing and I'll talk to some people from there still to this day. And so that influences, does that not influence when you and your fellow from China, you're talking about everyday life and you're dating and you're being young and you know more about China.
Mm-hmm.
Just by being with him. Mm-hmm. And so that influences what you do when you teach little children. I think the question I want to ask at this point is, are your children displaying any kind of thoughts or feelings or anxieties about any of this? What are their ages?
So depending on the class that I'm teaching, they're anywhere from like 5 or 6 years old up through middle school, so like 12 or 13, maybe 14 are the oldest ones. And actually, I noticed something really interesting yesterday when I was teaching one of my classes. There's these like YouTube videos that some teachers will show that have like riddles and things like that. And one of the kids was asking me why I don't show them. And I have noticed in watching them that some of them have very, very subtle but very strong kind of racist, sexist, like underlying their logic for some of their puzzles. And I'm not comfortable sharing that with kids, so I don't show them. But I had to have this conversation with like the kids in my class. And so I told them that I've noticed these things and that it's very subtle, so they might have not noticed them too, but they're there. And immediately all the kids were like, oh, okay, we don't want to watch that. And I was like, wow, that's a large amount of awareness for these 11 and 12 year olds to have, that as soon as I said that this is what I've noticed and it's really subtle, like even though it's subtle, they knew it was still a big deal. And so they were like, yep, okay, we're not going to watch that. And I was like, wow, that's amazing.
And prejudice stops you in your tracks, prejudice mm-hmm. of any kind. And what we had just read from Abdu'l-Baha, the Persian prophet, prejudice of any kind. And so that kind of brings, look for the similarities between religions. Major religions, all religions teach the golden rule and promises an age of peace. So why argue? And that's been going on again ever since we crawled out of the mud. And some priest or some religious person said, excuse me, I have a message for you, you muddy people, you. Stand up. Let's head over here to the love and light space and let's have some world peace, shall we? And I don't know, we just sort of muddled around and says, well, think about it. We'll just think about it. My mud religion is more important than you doing that, whatever you do. So there you go. What do you think? What's going on with that? And referring to your children, I have also, I used to teach at university, the older kids, but adults. Something I noticed from the time I taught many, many, many years ago I don't have very many people that have young children, or I don't really talk very much to teenagers or young adults these days, except you. But I do see when I'm having a coffee down at the square or whatever, I will hear bits and pieces of conversation, and the young people are just not having any of it. They're done. They want to be done. They're done. That's amazing to me. So it's the parents of the parents. You know, my parents didn't have any choice. They were born in World War II, coming out of World War I, born in poverty, had to go through the Depression because they were poverty-stricken. They didn't have much to give to us kids. But I do remember little bits and pieces of conversation about I don't want my two brothers and I would remember my parents would go, what they actually did was they're going to work our butts off so that our kids don't have to go through the crap we went through mm-hmm. at handoff, which is a form of working for peace within the family. Mm-hmm. And because of little bits and pieces of that, I was influenced to work my way out of that poverty, work my way out of all of that spiritual human gore, if you will, and become more spiritual, etc. I know you come from a family of, I know your mother, and she's fantastic. She wrote a book, didn't she?
Yes, she wrote a book about consultation, which is actually one of the topics that's talked about in this document.
So to elaborate.
Well, the idea behind it is that in order to work for peace, among other things, you really need to be able to collaborate well with other people. And so this process of consultation involves like listening very deeply to what other people are saying, letting go of like our attachment to our own opinions and like the things we think should happen, and like letting kind of the group work through a idea or a problem together. So instead of like one person trying to advance their agenda, it's like this process for a whole group to kind of brainstorm and think through a problem together and come up with a solution that maybe no one person would have come up with on their own, but that everyone is willing to support moving forward.
Listen carefully to the voices of women, which is, you know, what we address. Work to improve the quality of education. And there's your subject matter. I'm so proud of you. You worked hard to become a teacher, a math teacher. I know you got your degree, and you were one of my tutors, and you got your degree, and I remember you calling or emailing. I think you called and said, "I've got a job with the job I was dreaming for." So you've got a long stretch ahead of you to be an educator. So elaborate.
Yeah, I think the thing that I'm really learning right now is that I've done a lot of work to learn the subject material that I'm teaching, but now my job is to learn how to teach it well and how to teach these kids how to learn together. And I think that's the thing I'm really working on right now, is how do I help kids learn how to listen very attentively to each other and actually hear what their colleagues are saying, and to build off each other's ideas rather than just wait for their turn to say their idea. And it takes work, and it takes a lot of creativity to figure out how to both model that for kids and help them build the skills they need to be able to do that.
So I think what we're talking about is the voice of compassion, mercy, and empathy, which actually makes peace possible. And when nations all over the world and I believe this is what all the marches and all the ideas are. We're done with this. We can't do this anymore. When this mess is over, we got to start working with compassion, mercy, and empathy for each other. The more we learn, the more we realize how much we have in common. And isn't that the purpose of educating people? Is that commonality of you and I are human and we get up in the morning. It's not easy being a human being. It really isn't. Mm-hmm. And the more we learn, the more we're educated. And I know there's a, I remember there's a statement that says the most violent the most violent element in society is ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important as an educator too, and that was Emma Goldman that quoted that, and I have that as a sticker here on my wall. And something I've noticed, fear-based thinking produces fear-based people that are doing fear-based things.
I think just reiterating a lot of the things we already said, that probably the most important thing is you have to believe that it's possible. Like, if you don't believe it, it's not going to happen. And once you believe it, you just find like the small ways in your life that you can make little changes that might have ripple effects that move outward.
And everything, that's the whole point. It does have ripple effects.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't maybe it will. We do. Everything we do, if I'm kind at the grocery store, that has a ripple effect. If I'm kind in the hallway, I believe that kindness is a big, you know, kindness for me is one way to bring kindness to other people, because people are screaming for kindness right now.
Mm-hmm.
They're screaming for it. This is Emily DeHoff and Grace Gray Medicine for our The Promise of World Peace, third Wednesday of the month on KBOO. Today's show is on the promise of world peace. So I'm looking at this little pamphlet, this document, which I think you could probably get it on Amazon, or you could go to Baha'i.org and get it if you're interested in reading this. But it says here, the world is going through its teenage years and is immature and confused. No kidding, right? These are hard years, but can be made easier by realizing they are a necessary step towards maturity. Like a child reaching adulthood, the world will soon outgrow its past of war and violence. We can look forward to a future filled with peace. Pretty comforting, isn't it? Our loving, peaceful sides grow as we mature. We matter as we receive spiritual education. Right now, the world as a whole is still young and immature, as was said. This is why we often see more violence than love around us. So this is all about spiritual education, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this happens to be a Baha'i document, and I'm a Baha'i, but this isn't about being, we're not here to preach or try to, you know, talk about Baha'i. It just happens to be a Baha'i document on a very important subject, the promise of world peace. And I do want to say that the Baha'i shrines, Shrine of the Bab is a very beautiful, you go to, just look it up on Google and you'll go to a beautiful temple, which is actually a temple honoring one of the founders of the Baha'i faith. It is a religion, but it's not a religion. It's more than a religion. It's a world peace movement, and it's done in a very subtle, beautiful, peaceful way. We don't have preachers or clergy or ministers or only Baha'is can contribute and so on, so on. So, but what I wanted to make sure everybody understood about this recording, about this interview, is this document is a Baha'i produced document by what is called the Universal House of Justice, but which is in Haifa, Israel. But we are not Israelis. We in fact rent that property. We pay for that. We pay Israel to be on that spot. And Baha'is are not allowed to teach or share the Baha'i faith on any level outside of our beautiful compound. And you'll, if you go to the gardens, go to Baha'i.org and look up the Shrine of the Bab, and you will just see some beautiful gardens. And I was there in Israel. I did that years ago. I was there, and it's just a beautiful place. And again, this isn't about me being Baha'i trying to, you know, this is about we are one group of people that not only believe in world peace, but we work daily for world peace in our little arenas. Emily's shaking her head, but this is a radio show.
Yes, I'm agreeing.
And she works nights, so this is in the morning. So, so Emily, what do you want to say other than what we've said? But I want to wrap this up to, you know, so that it was wrapped up in and understood, because and there are many, many places that are giving producing world peace. Unitarian Universalists, the Quakers, tell me some of the things you know about world peace. I know your mother's very much into this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that like many different groups of people are working towards from many different angles, and this is just another angle that a large group of people are working towards peace from. And the more we can kind of see the different angles people are coming from and kind of join forces, then the faster the process will happen.
Science and technology gives us many wonderful tools which could be and are used for solving humanity's problems, but only if we overcome the barriers to cooperation. So we're looking at unity.
Mm-hmm.
The power of unity of all peoples towards a goal. There is so much violence in the world, and many people believe it's an unchangeable part of human nature, but it is not. It is not. And we go back to the first recording that talked about we have to believe that there can be world peace or there won't be world peace.
Mm-hmm.
How can we work for peace if we believe in our hearts that it is less natural than war? Our beliefs and actions must be in agreement or we become paralyzed. And mm-hmm. I think that's a lot of what's going on right now in the world, is people are paralyzed. We just came through a world COVID, you know, pandemic, a world pandemic that shut us down for at least a couple of years, and people were dying and frightened out of their minds and shut down, and life just got turned upside down for most people. And so we become paralyzed when we buy into, what's the word I'm looking for? Emily, you're an educator.
Like, I think when we're like the document says, when what we know should be happening doesn't align with what we believe about the world and how it works, then that's when we get paralyzed. So when, like, we recognize that what's happening in the world isn't working and we need something different, but we don't believe that something different is possible, that's, I think, when we get paralyzed and there's that discrepancy in ourselves.
Yeah. I'm reading right on a page out of the document right now. The Baha'is and any peace people, anybody that's a peace person, and that would be more peace, there are more peace people than there are war people
mm-hmm.
on the planet. I do believe that. And we understand that war and violence are not natural, but are distortions of the human spirit. So we're looking at the human spirit getting tricked into being paralyzed enough where the warmongers can actually do their thing, and we're standing there paralyzed, like, oh, what do we do? We don't know what to do. Oh my God, what do we do? What do we do? I think that's a lot of why, you know, this stuff happened over and over and over and over. And to know the human spirit will make it easier for people to believe in peace and work for it. For instance, we are born spiritual, having a human understanding, having a human awakening. We're actually born spiritual, having a human awakening, not the opposite. We're humans, and we have to look for the spiritual in us. We're already spiritual people. that know that oneness and unity and peace is not only possible, but it's our heritage as spiritual beings. I know that's very much my Native American background. I was taught that from a little kid on, that, you know, you're a spiritual being, act like it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The earth is but one country and mankind its citizens. That's a statement from Baha'u'llah, the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith. And again, this isn't about that. It's about one world peace movement that produced this beautiful document, The Promise of World Peace. And the only reason I wanted to do this, and I thank you, Emily, so much for coming on and interviewing with me.
Of course.
Because it's a hard subject to a certain extent. I so appreciate you, I really do, and I appreciate anybody that works for world peace. And it starts understanding that you are a spiritual being with one task in mind, and that's to stay in the light and love spot and don't let the darkness in you. And by the way, we are born with a dark nature, which is materialistic, needing power and needing, you know, which is the cause of war. I'm more powerful than you, and I'm going to win, and you're not going to win, and my religion is better than your religion, and so on and so on and so on and so on. And aha, it gets crazy, doesn't it, after a while?
Mm-hmm.
And when we drop that, and that's the darkness in us wanting, and it's fear-based thinking, wanting to be powerful, that's ego and selfishness and self-centeredness and me, and that is in us. That's scary, because it's in us. It doesn't come from outside to influence us. It's actually in us to be darker in nature. And I know I was very darker in nature until I had an intervention and some beautiful peace people came and said, you might want to try the love and light spot. And we're all at a point of choice where we can either choose to be fear-based thinking from our darker nature and just to be paralyzed and go, oh, there's no sense to it. Screw it, we're just going to have war, that's just the way it is, I'm just going to live my little life in the most comfortable way I can. Or I am at a point of choice between my dark nature and my light nature. And so at that point of choice, come to your light and love spot, because there's only light and love. That's all there is.
Mm-hmm.
There's only light and love. We were born with light and love, and that's who we really are. So I think when you understand who you really are, then that helps. And yes, I'll work for who I really am. Peace, yeah. Love, hope, and joy, right?
Yes.
Oh, Emily, thank you so much. And this is a better way to wrap that up.
Yeah.
Wrapping up the KBOO show. It airs. This is for KBOO.org. This is Negotiating Dramatic Events, Grace Growing Medicine. I'm lucky and blessed to have a show on KBOO called Negotiating Dramatic Events. And it's the third, it airs the third Wednesday of the month, every month, on KBOO. So thank you, Emily, for interviewing with me. And I really appreciate you. And
I will.
And say hello to all the children.
I will.
We will, just knowing we will have world peace. So here we go. Thank you, Emily, so very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Because it's KBOO time! KBOO time! Get KBOO'd up! Get KBOO'd up! Because it's KBOO time! KBOO time!
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. My day is shaped by my inbox, steady receipt from ocean organizations and advocates from around the world. It is a privileged onslaught, sometimes overwhelming by its fulsome information and aspiration, both encouraging and hopeful in a time of much misinformation and despair. A recent example was entitled A Forgotten Element in the Blue Economy, Marine Biomimetics and Inspiration from the Deep Sea, authored by Robert Blasiak from the Stockholm Resilience Center in Sweden, and a fascinating team of colleagues, and contributed to PNAS, a scientific journal published by Oxford University Press for the U.S. National Academy of Science. It caught my attention as a provocative perspective and creative framework for response in the moment. The abstract reads as follows. The morphology, physiology, and behavior of marine organisms have been a valuable source of information for solving conceptual and design problems. Here, we introduce the rapidly expanding field of marine biomimetics and identify it as a poorly articulated and often overlooked element of the ocean economy associated with substantial monetary benefits. We contend that marine biomimetics is not only a forgotten sector of the marine economy, but has the potential to drive appreciation of non-monetary values, conservation and stewardship, making it well aligned with notions of a sustainable blue economy, unquote. The article identifies seven broad categories of biomimetic design: adhesion, anti-fouling, armor, buoyancy, movement, sensory, and stealth. Over the next few editions of World Ocean Radio, I propose to discuss each with examples of application and technological invention illustrating monetary and non-monetary value derived from the close observation of nature as ocean phenomena, evident as efficient and effective models for response as a solution to negative human intervention in climate change, and as an additional argument for ocean protection and conservation. The article continues. Ocean exploration in recent decades has resulted in the discovery of deep sea ecosystems, where species have adapted to thrive under extremes of salinity, pressure, light, and temperature, including hydrothermal vents and brine pools. The potential for future discovery is vast. Half of the ocean reaches depths of 4,000 meters or more. Only 20% of the seabed has been mapped, and 70 to 90% of marine species remain undescribed. Real-time feeds from unmanned deep-sea submersibles are now freely available. Museums around the world are filled with specimens and collections of deep-sea life, and thousands of genetic sequences and even complete genomes of deep-sea organisms are freely accessible. Recent advances in ocean science and exploration have occurred alongside a dramatic expansion in the scope and diversity of ocean-based activities and industries. Today's ocean economy encompasses multiple industries as diverse as aquaculture, fisheries, oil and gas, offshore wind, cruise tourism, and marine biotechnology. In line with the UN Sustainable Development Goals and Agenda 2030, a variety of aspirational narratives have emerged of the ocean as a source of development that is not only sustainable, but also equitable and inclusive. This type of ocean economy has been described by some as a blue economy, a term that has become widely used in recent years, but which remains without a broadly agreed definition. A complementary narrative of exploration before exploitation underscores the loss that could accrue from embracing emerging extractive industries in the ocean, such as mining the seabed for metals and minerals, especially in the deep sea, where recovery from impacts is extremely slow or impossible. If mining and hydrocarbon extraction represent one approach to ocean resources, marine biomimetics represents a starkly different paradigm of resource use, unquote. It is this awareness of and exploitation through alternative, non-extracted, non-destructive, pro-sustainability ingenuity that is essential now in this time, when the forces of negative regress and entropy hold sway and the positive progress and hopefulness inherent in biomimetic alternatives represent the challenging choice before us. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KABU 90.7 FM.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. When considering how we must deal with the myriad challenges to the world ocean, the conversation comes always to questions of behavior and values. What must change in how we interact with ocean systems, with the marine environment, with exploitation of marine resources, with coastal protection and development, and with the economic and social necessities we expect the ocean to provide? Given the immensity of the challenge and the impossibility of a single fix that will make it all better, what specific interim steps must we take to move with all deliberate speed in the right direction? The ocean community has defined various short-term strategies, mitigation, for example, the direct tactical response to certain problems to negate or neutralize their effect. Adaptation is a second approach, one for which there is some logic, but which nonetheless compromises response by settling for the existing circumstances, the new normal, accommodating the lesser condition, lowering the bar, giving in. In past editions of World Ocean Radio, I've argued for a third response, invention, the proactive, creative approach that applies present and future technology, financial incentive, and political action to new ideas, new instruments, new behaviors, new values. Sustainability is a new value that is advanced to this end. It accepts the finite capacity of nature to support a burgeoning world population. It proposes new behaviors predicated on this knowledge that we will only exploit resources to an extent that allows for their renewal and sustainability over time. We will incentivize and promote this new value system through financial tools, price structures, legislative action, regulatory enforcement, and cooperative action. We will stop taking it all, acting unilaterally and independent for unlimited profit, and will reorganize ourselves to maintain and nurture the natural systems that have sustained us and continue to sustain us even as we grow in number over time, if we will make it so. But what can we do more to convince us at every level that sustainability is an essential core value for our future? Smarter folks than I are struggling with this problem, and clearly the struggle is necessary to counter those who will not consider or accept even the idea, much less the concomitant action required to make sustainability succeed. What else is required to convince the body politic that such destructive indifference by individuals, corporations, and governments is no longer acceptable? Where I live, we are celebrating a holiday of Thanksgiving. In that spirit, what we can do to show our gratitude, to recognize the opportunity in plenty, to give thanks for the fecundity and sustainability the ocean provides. Let me suggest the concept of reciprocity. This is not a new idea, to be sure, but perhaps it might be useful if applied in a new context. Reciprocity is a state of mutual exchange, the categorization of an action by its motivation and consequence in relationship to another. Indigenous peoples have practiced reciprocity as cultural behavior through direct barter and giving of gifts. The cultural anthropologist Claude Levi-Strauss identified levels of such exchange through language, kinship, and economics, a process that created bonds of social obligation, present and future, an idea familiar through the popular notion of a favor bank, a value on deposit that must be paid back in kind. What if we accepted the power of reciprocity as a standard of behavior at all levels, in all areas of exchange with nature? What if we acknowledged that the land and the sea provides us value, not for the taking and exhausting as an entitlement, but as the giving of a gift, the making of a loan, with the consequent obligation that we pay back that value in and through complementary behavior, equitable patterns of consumption, and forms of exchange that sustain nature through accepted future obligation? What if we accept such a reciprocal relationship and system of connection with nature as our obligation, our contribution to ourselves, our children, and the public good? We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org. Thank you.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down,